Welcome to the IAB UK podcast.
Hello, James here, and you're listening to the IAB UK podcast. This week, we're bringing you an International Women's Day special live from our last Thursday club event. Our host for the event was Emily Roberts, Senior Associate at PwC UK and co-founder of the Women in Programmatic Network. Joining Emily on the panel were Patricia Tarzan from View, Hannah Mirza from the Responsible Marketing Agency, and Nadia Sultana from the Trade Desk. Now, the panel quickly cut to the chase, addressing some of the big topics, including the pressing issue of gender pay disparity, the lack of meritocracy in hiring, and the need for education around unconscious bias. But they started with the theme of this year's International Women's Day, inspiring inclusion. And Emily kicked off the conversation by asking our panel what inclusion means to them.
Inclusion for me has always been enabling and creating a psychological safe space for each and every one. What do I mean by that? Ultimately for me, and if you do have a look at me on LinkedIn, you'll see my header says, be yourself. You should always be able to walk into any environment as who you are. And that's what it means for me.
For me, it just means feeling included or involved no matter what your background is. So whether your gender, your sexual orientation, your religion, you're involved in. And I think to kind of Trisha's point about kind of being authentically you, right? Being allowed to be who you are, no matter, again, what your background is.
Yeah, and just to build on what my panelists have said, I think at all levels, right? So, you know, inclusion has to be visible to you in the peers that you have. And I think as you go further up your career, you start to see that there's less of an inclusive environment, unfortunately, as testament to some of the data I'm sure you were just speaking. You want to have, like, inclusion, you know, be that age representation, sexual orientation, multicultural and gender at all levels of the business. And I think, unfortunately, in our industry and many others as well, as you get higher up, that tends to peter out. And I think, you know, our ambition would be for that to not be the case and for representation to be reflective of the society in which our companies operate at all levels of the business.
Yeah, very good points. And actually, so Marketing Week did a study and the results came out last month. And essentially, so the average gender pay gap in the UK is that women earn 7.7% less than men. And Marketing Week found that actually in the industry, it's 16% less. So we've got a lot of work to do. It's almost double in the industry. So to your point, we've got a lot of catching up to do, which I think brings us on to your roles. You've got some really incredibly important roles within this industry. I know, Trish, you've mentioned your D&I role. Could we hear a bit more about that, please?
Yeah, I think D&I for me, I think my own interest was born, obviously, out of my personal experiences. And I really developed the passion for it, being involved and kind of finding a niche as well, because then I went on from there. But it was when I was actually working for AOL. And for those that have been in the industry long enough to know the story about AOL, we obviously merged with Yahoo and then went through God knows how many other name variations. But in that time, Yahoo had a very established ERG structure, so Employee Resource Group, which focused on multiple areas of DE&I. And obviously, as part of merging, we as AOL then came into that. And so I got involved with the Neurodiversity ERG, was part of the lead group there for the EMEA region. And neurodiversity for me is quite close to home. It's a topic area I've done a lot of research into. I'm also a complementary therapist, so there's another hat that I wear as well. And so it moved from my interest there. When I left the company, it's then doing some more research around it as well and understanding what DE&I really means, because it isn't just neurodiversity. There's also a lot of other ERGs that you can focus and look at. But as time went on and I moved into different companies, it was always trying to see, first of all, in startups especially, whether or not actually we could start doing something and contributing efforts and drive. But in startups, typically, you'll always get the some excuses, we're not big enough, we don't have budget. And for someone like me, that's really hard to hear because, A, you don't need to be big enough because it's not about size, it's about the people. And secondly, you don't need to have budget to drive efforts. Then I was very fortunate. I retrained as a Reiki therapist. And part of that, I lead the efforts for the UK Reiki Federation. So completely separate and out of this industry altogether. But the complementary therapy industry is a completely different ballgame altogether, and there's a huge educational piece there that needs to be done. So I'm very fortunate in respect of what I've learned in our industry, because we are one of probably the most advanced industries, I want to say, because I've also worked in public sector government, where we really do, our efforts really do strive, and we have made huge strides forward and differences in comparison to some industry sectors. Now I work for View. And I want to say I'm privileged to work for a company who absolutely has it. It is part of our spine, it's part of our culture, and it's absolutely supported top down, down top. And the efforts that we there, so I'm part of the D&I committee there, and I don't know what else I do because I've lost my train of thought.
That's amazing.
But yeah, so you can tell I'm very passionate about it.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And so, Hannah, you're part of Bloom. You hold a very important role. You're the VP of Bloom at the moment. Could you tell us some more details about Bloom and what you're doing in
the
industry?
Sure. So I'm very lucky to be a volunteer at Bloom. Bloom is a industry network for women who are working in media, marketing, comms industry, and members basically get together and try and drive industry change, be that through events, research, and various other things. And I'm lucky enough to, through the community at Bloom, have a lot of Bloom members work at my company as well. And I think my passion for inclusion and diversity led me to ultimately setting up my own business. So the Responsible Marketing Agency, we are a consulting practice who specialize in ESG in relation to the media marketing industry. And we have a focus on inclusion and diversity around driving up representation in front of the camera, in the creative work, behind the camera, in the agencies, and through the camera in terms of the media and distribution. And so we're running programs for clients to help them do more representation in all aspects of the work they're doing. And then subsequently, you know, because it's a people business, we launched a responsible resourcing agency with a focus on driving more diverse talent into our industry. And so working with that business to help foster greater numbers of diverse talent into our industry and kind of work from the ground up on fixing the dynamics from that perspective as well. And I guess my work day to day interjects with my Bloom work. And, you know, while Bloom is focused heavily on women's representation, I think the wider agency work is broader than that around, you know, all aspects of multiculturalism and sexual orientation and identity, and a bit broader as well.
And so we've mentioned there are a lot of barriers, right, to inclusivity, sadly, at the moment. Nadia, I'm really interested to hear what you think the kind of key barriers are in our industry.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of nepotism in our industry. I think it's a lot of, you know, I know this person, I know that person, let me get them in. And what that creates is a vacuum of people that look like each other, and that's why it doesn't foster a culture of inclusivity. And I think it's not just an industry thing, but I think it's just a generic thing. People are always like, oh, I just want to hire someone that's good at the job, doesn't matter about skin colour. But, you know, we don't live in a fair society. People aren't kind of hired on meritocracy, right? They're actually, it's to do with similar experiences, etc. You know, an example that I have is, and something I've heard firsthand as well, is, you know, people saying things like, they've had two people at the end stage, and then obviously you can't ask them what if they drink alcohol, so they'll say, what's your favourite drink? And if they say like a mocktail, for example, rather than an alcoholic beverage, they're like, oh, they won't be a good cultural fit, because that means they won't go out on Media Thursdays, they won't get drunk, etc. And that in itself, again, just feeds into the thing of like, it's not on merit, right? It's people that look like you, sound like you, etc. So I think that's a massive barrier in itself. And I think also kind of lack of education as well. So, you know, I think we're going to touch on it later, but like, you know, not being able to understand how, you know, unconscious bias feeds into, you know, the way we see people. You know, I think we were talking about earlier, like, you know, having a CV with someone's name on it that you can't pronounce, you probably might not regard it because, like, I can't even pronounce their name, so I'll just put it away, for example. So I think that's another kind of barrier. And I think also making, if we think about equity versus equality, you know, we need to make equitable opportunities for people. So this is where, you know, companies need to have quotas, I think. So, you know, having X amount of women in senior leadership position or hiring more people of colour, for example. So we're, again, just creating opportunity. And I think Karen Blackett said something, you know, there's so much talent, but there's not enough opportunity. And that's where, as an industry, we need to do more. So create kind of equitable opportunities for people of underrepresented backgrounds.
I just want to add to the equitable part, because we discussed this before, which was absolutely, when Nadia mentions quotas, that doesn't necessarily mean, oh, well, quotas mean you haven't fulfilled the quota, so therefore we're on a hiring spree right now, we just tick that box. It doesn't mean that. It means that you are consciously aware of what the business needs to address. But let's just say we're focusing on the hiring aspect. You still are making sure that you're hiring the right person for the job, whether that is, whether it be experience, whether it be, you know, what they've got to bring to the team. You're not just ticking the box. So equitable, yes, but not just for the sake of the exercise.
Another barrier from my perspective as well is like the lived experience. So, you know, if you're a woman and you've encountered misogyny, or if you're, you know, gay and you've encountered homophobia, or if you're, you know, from an ethnic background and you've encountered racism, even if it's at the micro level, it really can impact your positivity about our sector and having a long-standing career in it. And I think that aspect is a barrier when there aren't necessarily the things in place to support someone who's experienced that to have a positive outcome, and or the people who are perpetrating that to, you know, be held to account and stop it. So I think that can really dictate your longevity in the industry, how you experience, and that kind of personal internalization of those experiences if you're successful in the outcomes you have.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And actually, so the Women in Work report highlighted two things to kind of the barriers towards essentially equal pay. And it's the first time I've heard this, but it's called, there's a name around like how people are getting more greedy jobs, essentially. So essentially, when we talk about greedy jobs, it's you're working longer hours than we've ever done before in this digital world. And also the hours are more predictable. So I know a handful of people where at kind of midnight, their boss will be like, oh, can you just jump on and quickly send this email? Like, obviously, 20, 30 years ago, you'd have had to go back into the office to do that. Like, it wouldn't have been possible. And so because of that, with women usually being kind of taking on more unpaid care, it means that it's just not possible for women as much to essentially go back into these greedy jobs, as we're calling them now. The second one was essentially around the gender gap negotiation, and this is probably a key one for everyone in the room. So one of the biggest findings was that women are less willing to negotiate salary. So if you take one thing away from this, you can negotiate your salary and have that conversation. It's incredibly uncomfortable to have, but that is one of the reasons why there is still a gender pay gap, and I'm sure that is one of the reasons that our gender pay gap in the industry is pretty bad. So yeah, ask for more. So those are the two kind of barriers. I'm really interested to know about the strategies that we have, and you work for some brilliant companies that have come up with some brilliant strategies. Trish, I know that you are doing a lot in this space. I'm really interested to hear from you.
Yeah, so I also want to go back to this point as well, because I didn't mention this. I have mentioned Vue a couple of times. When Emily was just talking about, you know, women are not necessarily bold, brave enough to actually negotiate salaries, from my own personal experience, that comes with experience and that comes with time. I think that comes also as your confidence grows, and maybe the confidence within yourself grows. Then all of a sudden you step out and you start to be big and bold. That's absolutely what happened with me. What part of that big and bold was actually when I was interviewing. And instead of going, oh, I was going to use a bad word then. Don't use a bad word. Instead of saying, oh God, I need to get a job, this time it was, no, I'm going to get the right job for me. That right job for me is the job. It's the company. It's who I'm working for. It's going to be my package overall, not just my salary, the whole lot. And that is what I did when I was interviewing. When I took the role and my job, my current job at Vue, part of that was actually speaking to our Chief People Officer, Liz Dowling, who is the person behind the scenes really doing a stellar job in everything that she does for building the spine of our culture. Liz and I had a two-hour conversation in my final screening, and I grilled Liz, and it was all about culture. It was all about what are the efforts that you were doing to promote X, Y, and Z that are going to be really important to me. And I thought to myself, if Liz tells me a load of things that I know are going to be fluff, I'm not taking the job. That's it. But she didn't. And actually, she does live and breathe it internally now. And obviously, it comes out in respect of the policies and what we have in efforts as well. A part of that at VUE is that we have a hybrid model workplace. And that hybrid model has been built on three principles. It addresses the people themselves, it addresses safety, and it addresses flexibility. But the one that I'm going to highlight the most, because this is the one that's the most important to me and that I talk about a lot, is the safety aspect. So creating a psychological safe place to come to work and to be at work. We are extremely fortunate that we have an external trainer come in, and that external trainer addresses multiple topics within DE&I. I've gone through the training sessions twice now, and I was saying to the ladies, in the first session, I was there going, oh God, I know all of this. This is so boring. I'm not learning anything. Fabulous. Okay, great. Second session, where our trainer covered some of the same topics, I didn't sit there and say that time. I sat there and went, right, okay, you need to address this, Trish. You need to work on this, Trish. And actually, it started sinking down at a much deeper level. So instead of it just being a knowledge thing that I was being trained on, and okay, great, I can now go away and talk about inclusivity, allyship, actually it was like, what are you going to do? How are you going to do it? What do you need to work on? So yeah, that's one of the strategies that can be put.
And I know, so at Bloom, you've got some really great examples and strategies, especially on a project called The Exchange.
Yeah, so there's several at Bloom I'll touch on, but The Exchange is one, which is around finding and kind of pairing men in the industry with women in the industry to help to have a very like peer-to-peer conversation about the lived experience of women in the industry, with the view to helping to educate and drive allyship and get more men in the industry supporting the advancement of women's situations. And it's, you know, been running for several years now, and one of the programs I highly recommend for men in the industry to apply for and get involved with. They also have some great policies that have been created, education guides on returning to work for, we were talking earlier about you can feel probably at your most vulnerable in that period after you've had a child and returning to work, and some of the things that could be done to provide allyship for returning parents coming back into the workforce. The same if we're thinking about later life, there's a lot of new kind of advancements around supporting women going through menopause, and there's a great Bloom guideline around that. So I think the resources are out there, and when they're not, you know, there's organizations who are interested in helping to drive their creation. What's not there is more wide adoption and, you know, proactivity from people who are managing teams to really put themselves in the shoes of someone who's not from their background, not from their kind of lived experience, and understand, oh, I might experience the world in a different way if I had that kind of pressure going on in the outside world, or based on, you know, my background that I'm not necessarily used to. And I think that proactivity around educating yourself if you are a leader or a manager makes a huge difference to your employees and ultimately your business outcomes, because if people feel safe and supported in their workplace, they're going to perform at a higher level and drive your objectives forward. And so as a business, and so I think it's like the right investment to make as a leader in a business.
Yeah, absolutely. I think allyship is, yeah, incredibly important. And I know, Nadia, we've had quite a few conversations on this as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think I want to touch on what both of you guys said. I think on your side, Hannah, you're talking about kind of lived in experiences, and that's where I think intersectionality is so, so important. Like, obviously we're all women on this panel, but we're all different, right? Like, I'm Bengali and I'm Muslim, and, you know, somebody on the panel won't experience Islamophobia or racism, right? And that's what, when we're talking about, particularly, you know, around women's issues, we have to understand people have different issues that they're facing. And that's why, you know, we need to stand up for all women, not just some. To your point, Trish, about psychological safety, I think it's so important. We do have safe spaces, because at the end of the day, you know, if I give an example, so if I said at work, a male colleague and, you know, I were having a conversation and he referred to me as emotional, I know most women in this room will understand he's being misogynistic, right? I don't have to contextualize it. I don't have to give you a background story about it. You already know, right? And that's what psychological safety does. It allows you to be authentically you without conceptualizing. And that's where organizations like Me First or Media for All, and I'm not sure if everyone in this room have heard of them, but they're a safe space for people of color to ensure that, you know, Black and Asian and kind of minority ethnic talent thrives in the industry, as well as that talent is retained. And I think that's where, again, tying into, you know, how are we hiring? And another kind of point I was going to come into is we need senior leadership buy-in when it comes to strategies being implemented at our companies. Like, if at a senior level everyone looks the same, obviously these kind of conversations will end here, right? It won't go up to the top. And that's why we need to have things like quotas in place and trainings around unconscious bias and allyship. And I think allyship is so, so important. I think the word is thrown around quite a lot, and I think a lot of us in this room would like to think we're allied to something or someone or some sort of organization, but, you know, sometimes we find it hard to actually tangibly, how do I, you know, be an ally? You know, particularly, let's say as a woman of color, I say to my white counterpart, someone just said something, you know, racist to me. What do you even say in that situation, right? So this is where, you know, I like to give the example. Allyship is just, you know, in a classroom, let's say I've had my hand up the whole time and someone else just goes, oh, miss, look, her hand's been up. Can she answer that question? And that's all it is. It's just a helping hand. No one's saying you need to go lobby the government or, you know, change rules, etc., right? Everyone's, it's just about these little changes every single day you can do to make people from underrepresented background feel included and involved.
Just building on what Nadia was saying, we were talking previously about, you know, we're very familiar with this word microaggressions. Mm-hmm. And I have this passion for having this thing called micro empowerments, where, you know, when there's these like little moments of opportunity to boost someone up and to support someone who's feeling underrepresented, that you say the thing that empowers them instead of the thing that would, you know, bring them down. And particularly in situations where there was a microaggression, just having the confidence to say, you know, oh, hold on, that's not right. I don't agree with you. And give that kind of backing to the individual in the moment. And so I'd love to see this movement of micro empowerments in the industry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So our final question of tonight, I know we've got a long way to go in terms of changing the industry and making everyone feel included, but I'd love to hear from you guys. If there's one takeaway you have around positive inclusion, what is it? Shall we start with you, Nadia?
Yeah, I think as an industry, firstly, I think it's really good the direction we're going at. I think, but there's still a lot of progress to be made. But I think just continuing on the theme of allyship, I think particularly when the Black Lives Matter movement happened, I think so many people woke up and realized, you know, I have to do something about this. Like, you know, I have to be part of a cause. I have to stand up for something. And I think the momentum was so great a few years ago. And I think now it's sort of slow down a bit. And so I don't think a catastrophe should, you know, ignite us to be passionate about causes. We should always have that passion. We should always be seeking to learn. And I think the positive thing about the industry is we are doing more events like this. And, you know, for example, at the Trade Desk, we're doing such great events like London Voices, where people talk about, you know, their IVF journey or their neurodiversity journey or living with vitiligo. Like, as an industry, we're so much more welcome to people who don't look like each other, you know, who are coming from underrepresented backgrounds. So it's just lovely that people are just being, I think, kinder to each other as an industry, which is super, super nice to see.
And I'm probably going to pick up on the point where Nadia has said that the industry, it seems that people are being kinder to one another. So if we take a step back, my personal view on examples of positive inclusion has to start from ground zero. So we start from the educational piece. And the reason it starts from the educational piece, and this, by the way, is not a one-off. Like I said to you at the very beginning, that I'd done so much reading after my part at AOL when I left, that all the research and reading that I'd done, it was like, brilliant, okay, great, I really understand the ins and outs of sort of D&I and why I want to focus on it and the different areas to it. But actually, it's continuous learning. And the reason it has to be continuous learning is because I think the biggest change that has to happen is the unconscious bias part. And trust me when I say that's something that you have to reprogram yourself. And if you know anything about neural pathways, you're at least looking at minimum 21 days where, you know, you've got the possibility of retraining and moving what has been set in. And 21 days for unconscious bias, I think, is nothing. So I think positive inclusion starts with training. It starts with education. And then it starts with the individual, because the individual is then the collective. You know, again, one of the things that we're doing at VUE, and I want to point this out because I think it's fantastic, we're currently going through the process of building out a prayer place. For those, I think it's Ramadan now. So we're currently building that out. We do have a place to accommodate through religious periods for those that are in the office. But alongside of the prayer room, we are also, we accommodate and adjust flexible working hours. So it allows for those that obviously are fasting, you know, you're not having a meeting at 4 p.m. where you're probably brainwise have switched off. So we also have brought that in as well in terms of flexible hours through those periods to accommodate everyone that needs it to be adjusted. So there are things that you can do, but it starts training, education, and then the individual to then become the collective is positive inclusion.
Yeah, and just to add, you know, that we're all human at the end of the day, and we all have an opportunity to support like people on an everyday basis, you know, that we're working with. And I think be confident to speak up, and, you know, in the lack of a company investing in training or the lack of, you know, having access to necessary the resources, take the opportunity to find some resources yourself and just start to be a voice for those who feel underrepresented in your organization, and have the conversations and be that ally, I think, across any aspect of intersectional representation that exists in your business.
Fab. Thank you, everybody.
Emily Roberts from the Women in Programmatic Network, Patricia Tarson from VUE, Hannah Mercer from the Responsible Marketing Agency, and the Trade Desk's Nadia Sultana there. Micro-empowerments as opposed to microaggressions, I think, was my favourite takeout. A very small way of showing up every day and making sure everyone in the room feels included. Don't forget, IAB UK members can attend our last Thursday Club events for free. The March edition will be looking at creator marketing and is ready and waiting for you to book on our website. We'll include a link to that in the show notes. And if you enjoyed this podcast, may I gently guide you to take a look through our back catalogue, where you'll find previous International Women's Day specials. They are just as excellent and just as thought-provoking as today's episode. And if you're still here, I hope that means that you love the pod. So please remember to rate, review, follow, and share all of the good stuff. It really does make a difference and means we can just keep growing and growing this podcast. For now, though, thank you very much indeed for listening.
IAB UK, building a better future for digital advertising for the benefit of everyone.